So that ability to connect is really important. And I just want to say that as we face such an uncertain time, we at the UUA and the UUCF realize that there is a very real need to connect, if not physically, then psychologically and spiritually, and that that connectedness is going to help serve us well. And that is why all of us on the committees and the staff at UCF realize that for today's call, it's really important to let you know that we are in a position to help you provide all the support our congregation needs.
All guests have been muted.
For today and in the future. So with the future in mind, let's take a look at the materials and our performance and see how it will be able to sustain us as we move forward. I'm going to also provide highlights of our meeting, as I mentioned, and also give you some upcoming information on where you'll find us at General Assembly. And as Andrew mentioned, we're going to have plenty of time for your questions. So I'm going to start on slide 3 with the performance review. I'll be referring to materials that are available on the website if you didn't get them in the invitation. This first slide shows gross returns as of December 31 of last year. Now, I know that that certainly feels like a long time ago and may not be as relevant today, but I think it will, it gives a good perspective on the success of our long-term approach and how our disciplined asset allocation rebalancing has benefited us. So as you look at slide 3, please focus on the dark blue circles.
All guests have been muted.
Is there any chance that that message about being unmuted can stop? In any event, this page is looking out across a number of time periods. What's important to note is that all of the results across all of these time periods from the quarter ending December 31 through 1 year all the way to 10 years, all of those returns, results, are, with the exception of the 7 year, are above median, with a number of them in the top quartile. So if we now turn to slide 4, we're going to get you as up to date as we can with performance results from February 29th of this year. These are the most recent numbers that we have that are available to us and are also an excellent example of how well our asset allocation is working for us. And I'm going to focus on primarily the year-to-date and the one-year returns. The year-to-date returns are just about smack in the middle of the slide, and then two columns over to the right are the one-year numbers. I think that those time periods give you a good sense of how the asset allocation is holding up as the markets began to experience more volatility. For this time period, broad equity markets in the developed world were down roughly 8% year-to-date. Emerging markets were down about 10%. On a one-year basis, the U.S. equity markets were positive, and developed international markets were a modest negative, and we'll see that on slide 5, where our managers were up almost 5% over the last year, and our emerging market managers outperformed by 100 basis points. So being diversified across equity markets in not only U.S. markets, but international and emerging markets has been a good benefit to us in the most recent time period. So the equity performance is on slides 4 and 5. And now I'm going to move to slide 6 to take a look at how our fixed income portion of the fund has returned. Our fixed income portion of the fund has experienced positive returns across all time frames. If you look at the top of slide 6, you will see all positive numbers. And I would highlight that about a third of the way down that graph or slide, I should say, you'll see the returns on government bonds or U.S. treasuries, and those have produced above average returns. They almost look as if that would be a component of the equity allocation. This has been a great benefit to provide some ballast to the fund, although I will tell you that in terms of value, we view these above average returns as reward in a lower risk category and that they are likely to be unsustainable. And that's where the benefits of asset allocation and our rebalancing are really going to become important. What we're seeing in the government bond markets today is a classic flight to quality. Central banks are continuing to provide monetary stimulus as rates here in the U.S. get closer to where the markets in government bonds in Europe are trading at the zero bound. And this creates a benefit and an opportunity to rebalance. And the way we can do that is if you focus on how we're positioned in a very diversified way, similar to how the equity portion is diversified across different types of equity markets, domestic, U.S., international, or emerging, in fixed income, we have a balanced allocation to high-quality fixed income, which holds our treasury position of 2% and our significant allocation to short-term duration at just about 7%. In the flexible fixed income portion, we're able to diversify away from what is the traditional risk in fixed income of duration, and we're able to add different types of fixed income risk by having allocations to managers who have the ability to invest either globally or with a specific eye towards parts of the credit market. We think those are areas that potentially offer good sources of long-term return and increased income or yield potential. We think of that high quality portion as providing liquidity and stability. Sorry about the dog. as interest rates move lower, there's less of an income component to provide that ballast. For that reason, we've limited the exposure to long-duration fixed income with a 2% position, as I managed. And it gives us an opportunity to realize the gains we've made to rebalance in areas that offer better long-term return. The flexible income portion has outperformed equities in the near term. And as I mentioned earlier, we look to this to be a source of diversification away from the traditional risk in fixed income markets. Another important allocation to note is on slide 7, which is our private markets positioning, which is fairly small at 5%. And so the bulk of our assets are in very liquid and tradable securities with decent return potential. we are confident that with this well-diversified endowment fund and with the disciplined rebalancing, this will allow us to get through the current market volatility. And so with that, I'd like to move to slide 8 to take a broader look at what exactly does our asset allocation look like and where will there be opportunities to tap areas of the fund in order to be able to navigate and take advantage of the current market environment. I think the important point that you will see here is that, one, our public equity overweight does limit our exposure to less liquid markets. Longer term, we have an allocation that we would like to increase, but we are doing that on a very disciplined basis before we make investments in those areas. And most of the investments that we have made of late are aligned with our UU values and have an ESG capability to most of them. What you also see here is a policy that is currently in the allocation is in line with the current policy. So while we do have actions that we can take, they're not large, and they will be targeted towards areas that offer the best return. Of most importance to us at this juncture is if you go down to the flexible fixed income portion, if you go down to the third dark green bar, which says high quality fixed income, the current allocation is 13.4, and our long-term policy, given what we expect for long-term returns from high quality fixed income, we are overweight specifically in the short duration category, as I mentioned. That was a position that arose earlier, but at a later last year when we liquidated our position in the opportunistic area, and our position in GMO allowed us to take the proceeds and put them into a short duration, high quality, essentially a near cash-like holding. And it's currently invested in FICA for impact, so it has a double win as well. But you'll notice that the current allocation is at 6.5, which is above our long-term policy of 3. It's that combination of the cash that we currently hold and that overweight in short duration that gives us additional liquidity beyond our long-term policy and will allow us to be able to meet the draws on the fund from congregations that have planned spending as well as if their spending exceeds their current budget expectations. So the asset allocation is the key to really providing us with a good defense in this current market environment. There's some fund commentary as well, but I've already covered that. And I will briefly share with you the highlights from the investment committee portion of our meeting. The four things that we covered on the IC side, although I can tell you that there were many members from the SRIC there as well. February is generally a time when we review our asset allocation since it's the beginning of the year. And we do that in the context of our consultant, NEPC's long-term investment outlook. That left us with the asset allocation decisions that we made, and I just reviewed for you. What was interesting in NEPC's outlook is that the 10-year return assumptions going forward are considerably lower. The two areas that offer the best long-term opportunity are emerging markets and private equities. But you'll notice in that allocation that we're pretty well balanced and, again, very close to where we want to be long-term. We also discussed a work plan for 2020. That work plan really allows the two committees to effectively work on timely reviews of our managers and getting updates from all of them and keeping an eye on managers where we do have high exposure. It also helps us drive our quarterly agendas for our committee meetings, so we are able to make sure that throughout the year we take dedicated time to review investment policy, allocation, and investment outlook as we did at the February meeting, and also to work effectively with the SRIC to review and adjust our screening criteria so that it's important that the policy reflects our UU values. The last item on the IC side was we heard from a new manager, a manager presentation. Ownership Capital is a long-only sustainable public equity manager based in the Netherlands. Their strategy is to invest for the long term, which aligns with our strategy, and also actively engages with companies to improve sustainability and make improvements in governance as well. So this is a strategy that really met all of the characteristics for a strategy that would fit well within our total allocation. Their track record also has produced superior returns. So with that, we decided to invest $10 million with Ownership Capital, and the funds are coming from a reduction in Sands Capital in a like amount of $10 million. So that covers most of what I wanted to talk about. I don't know if Kathy's been able to join at this point.
Yeah, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes. So glad you could join us.
Excellent. Yes. Thank you, Kathleen. So I'll give a rundown on some really important progress we've had in the socially responsible investing arena, starting with our work as active shareholders and our engagement with companies in the UCEF portfolio, as well as some broader advocacy for shareholder rights. So we have been over a period of a couple of years now engaging with groups within the denomination that work on social justice issues related to human rights, and we had a very fruitful ongoing dialogue regarding a proposed business resolution for consideration at General Assembly this year on embodying human rights in our investment decisions. So those groups, which include UUs for Justice in the Middle East, Black Lives UU, UU Rise, UU Peace Ministry Network, and UU Ministry for the Earth, succeeded in getting enough signatures from individual members and numbers of congregations to qualify this resolution on embodying human rights in our investment decisions for this year's General Assembly. We are really welcoming the opportunity that will present to elevate the consideration of how UU values are reflected in investment decisions by the UUCEF and by individual congregations, by individual UUs. We have also set up a screening subcommittee on human rights that is going to be working with our consultant, Sustainalytics, to further develop our screening criteria in that area. So we'll continue to report on that. And then through the shareholder advocacy, which is which we continue to be playing an active leadership role with Tim Brennan, our former treasurer, working as a consultant. There have been a number of advances. The UUA was active along with other socially responsible investors in opposing changes to Securities and Exchange Commission rules that would make it much more difficult for active shareholders to exercise their ownership rights over public companies. And so there'll be ongoing efforts to really prevent the rollback of shareholder rights to file proposals with public companies. We also continue to be engaged with companies in the Climate Action 100 Plus. These are the largest corporate greenhouse gas emitters, and the UUA serves as a lead with several of these companies, including lead investor with Devon Energy and co-lead with CalPERS on Exelon. And then in addition, we have for a long time been leading engagement with public companies about disclosure of lobbying and political activity, and partnering with Walden Asset Management and AFSCME in that area. And we had served as lead filer with joined by Fresh Pond Capital with BlackRock on a lobbying disclosure resolution. And in dialogue, the company agreed to significant improvements in its lobbying disclosure. So that resolution was withdrawn, and you can, there's a link in the slides to a blog on the UUCEF website about that success and advance. So that work has been going really well. If you look at slide 11, we are really making great progress in our community investing with leadership from committee member Vanessa Lowe. And I think we talked with you on the last call about increasing the portfolio allocation to 5% of our portfolio for community investments. This is going to be all the more critical now given the economic impacts and the impacts on public health at the community level of the coronavirus. This means that the Common Endowment Fund will be putting $8 million more into community investments, building up toward that. And we continue to have matching funds available for your congregations making community investments as well, up to $10,000. So we did make a significant new investment at the February meeting, which is really exciting to the Working World, which is doing business as Seed Commons. This is a network of more than 25 member funds that support cooperative development nationwide. And really invest to create equitable opportunities for workers. So here again, there's a great link on the slide to an inspiring video about the worker owners at New Era Windows Cooperative. So just to wrap up, on slide 12, we've got some highlights about our presence at the upcoming General Assembly, in the expectation that the event will be able to go off as planned. In June, we are organizing a workshop with joint leadership from the Investment Committee and the Socially Responsible Investing Committee on mobilizing investments to advance UU values. That will be on Thursday, June 25th in the late afternoon. Vanessa Lowe, as our lead on community investment, will be participating in a workshop on stewardship and money as medicine, which is also on June 25th. And as I previously mentioned, we'll be supporting this business resolution to provide more detailed guidance on embodying human rights in our investment decisions. And we also plan to have a booth in the exhibit hall that will be staffed by members of both of our committees. So that's it for highlights, lots of them from the Socially Responsible Investing Committee side, and I'll turn it back over to Andrew to moderate the Q&A.
All right. That sounds good. Thank you, Kathy. So, bear with me just 1 second. I'm going to unmute everybody's line.
All guests have been unmuted.
Sorry, I have the phone talking in the background. If you're not immediately asking a question, I would ask that you either use the mute feature on your phone, or you can control whether your line is muted by hitting *6. That'll keep the feedback down on the line and be able to hear answers from Kathleen and Kathy a little more easily. So, that's it. We'll open it up for questions now. Just introduce yourself and let us know what your question is.
This is Pam Springsteel in Columbia, Missouri. Our local congregation is planning on investing $10,000 in a local school bond. Is that considered community investment? This is
Kathy,
Pam.
Do you
want to
handle that one?
Oh. Kathy, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So there is information about the Community Investing Match Program on the Common Endowment Fund website, and we can definitely provide that to you. I'm not sure about the specifics of that investment, but and I don't know if Andrew or Vanessa can. But we can definitely send you the link and the match form.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know that we traditionally match municipal bond investments, although I don't know that we would categorically rule it out either. So, yeah, just review the materials and we can perhaps chat about that offline.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Curtis
hi,
Bell.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Curtis.
Thank you. I just have a question about understanding the data here. My understanding is that the Common Endowment Fund has monies that they manage individually and individual securities, equities, and fixed incomes. And then they have all the managed funds. And all that I see here in the summary things are all managed funds. I don't quite see where the individual stock funds, the individual stocks are included in this summary data. It's just a point of understanding what this data that is given to us in the first few slides.
So yeah, so this represents the vast majority of our investments, both UUA and congregational investments. You are right that we do own a handful of individual stocks, although this is mainly designed such that we can engage with those companies on environmental, social, and governance issues. They're not necessarily part of our broader investment strategy, but in order to have resolutions at annual meetings or whatnot, we do have to have some positions in individual shares. Those are sort of it's a de minimis amount compared to the overall size of the endowment fund, so they're not broken out on any of those reports that you see.
I thought that you have individual funds, individual stocks of like $60 million. Then you have a separate category of what you use for shareholder activism. $82 million in individual company that are managed by the UUA.
Yeah, so I see where you see the $60 million on there. So that's basically our kind of domestic U.S. equity position. That is all managed by outside money managers, not directly by the UUA. Some of those funds have different strategies than others. The two big ones on there are Rumbline and Sands. The Rumbline is more of an enhanced index fund strategy. So we screen out the types of names that we don't like to invest in and other companies that are lagging on ESG dimensions. And that, whereas the SANS is a more concentrated fund, they have, it's basically like a mutual fund. They have fewer names in the portfolio, and then they work to engage the companies that they invest in on ESG issues, similar to the new investment, the ownership capital that Kathleen was talking about. So yeah, I hope that helps. We don't invest directly in individual companies. We rely on, with the exception of the bit that we have in our advocacy portfolio.
And Andrew, if I can just add to that, I think
sure.
What is difficult to see on the slides is that some of our managers have a separately managed account them, and in those situations, and Rumline is a good example, we are able to give them guidelines and screening criteria that reflect our view principles. The smaller allocation to be invested in a commingled vehicle, which is they are not mutual funds, but they're similar to that for institutional market and or institutional investors, I should say. And when we're invested in those vehicles, we don't necessarily have the ability to direct them to follow our screening criteria. But that also means that when we're looking at managers where the investment options are in commingled vehicles, we do review them for their ESG capabilities so that they might more closely align with our values. That is an additional way that we can meet those goals by identifying managers who practice ESG and are able to do so by delivering good results. And more managers are beginning to do that. But that's an important distinction in terms of we're able to actually give for guidelines for our separate account managers.
That's helpful. Thank you. So there was someone was going to ask a question when Curtis jumped in. And I'm sorry I cut you off if you're still out there.
Yeah, this was someone you may have remembered, Tim Brennan. So I just wanted to make a quick comment on the slide, the SRI slide, under shareholder engagement and advocacy, it says BlackRock agrees to expand lobbying and disclosure. It makes it sound like the UUA was trying to get BlackRock to lobby more. That's not the case. But we got them to expand their lobbying disclosure. So no and in there. We'd like it if they'd lobby less, but if they're going to lobby, we want them to disclose the amounts they spend and how they oversee it.
Thank you so much for that
clarification. Thank you, Tim.
This is John Nielsen from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I have a question on slide 3.
Okay.
Can you explain the percentile things on the bottom of the page there, please?
Sure. So if you look at the blue bar at the top, you'll see that it says composite versus investment metrics, all endowment, 50 to 200 million. So quartiles are divided by the returns of peers. Those are similar endowments of a similar size, not necessarily all ESG funds, but all endowments. And so when you look at the bottom three lines of the table, you see that the composite, which is the endowment fund, for example, looking at the most recent quarter as of December 31, the composite returned 6.2% which ranked it 15th in a total universe of 68. So the number of portfolios that we were measured against, 68, ranking us 15th, which falls into that percentile top. So looking at the box, you'll see the four quartiles. The blue circle is in that top quartile, which begins at any fund that earned 5.8% or more. And really, you want to make sure that your returns are above the second quartile or above the third or above median, that you're performing better than your peers. It is a return measure that is, but also gives the absolute return numbers as well. And certainly for that quarter, a 6.2% return was a return for that market. Does that help answer the question, John?
Yes.
This is Ward Kelsey from Pittsburgh.
Hi, Ward. Go ahead.
You got me? I'm going to jump to a question I think is on a lot of minds, and certainly on mine. Let me say something very briefly myself, and then I'll ask my question. I'm like all of us, I think, highly concerned about the situation with the virus and the pandemic. And one of the things my observation about it is that this is unlike a lot of the other, or almost any other crash that we have seen recently, in that this seems to me to represent more than just a failure of financial markets. This looks like actual worldwide economic contraction. Now, whether it's going to be temporary or longer term, that I guess still remains to be seen. But I am very concerned to hear if you all agree with my assessment, and secondly, if you do, or if you don't, for that matter, what do you think is a sensible strategy for the UCEF to be taking right now in light of what I conceive to be sort of a qualitatively different kind of an economic crisis that we find ourselves in now?
You're exactly right. This is not that there was ever a typical crash, but this doesn't look like anything in, for many of us, our history of the market. And I think you're right that it's here of the market. It really is a question what the eventual economic impact is going to be. And that is truly an unknown. And I realize that that creates a lot of anxiety for everyone, primarily about the virus, which is a health crisis. But in order to deal with it successfully, it's having a significant economic impact that we don't know the depth or the length of. That's a lot of uncertainty. However, where I feel that it was so important to review our current asset allocation and recognize that if we look out over the next 10 years and we are close to our long-term policy, we are going to be in good shape. The other part that is unknown but is becoming more and more evident every day is it's not only the central bankers that are providing global stimulus to the market. It's also the fiscal stimulus that's going to come from the policymakers. And we've seen Europe begin to act, and the United States is beginning to pass legislation in order to provide a since you don't know exactly what shape or form will come in, but I have confidence that while it may take some time to work out the details, there will be continued short-term volatility. We have the ability, given our current solid liquidity position and a couple of key areas where we may have some overweight, and the overweights in treasuries, overweight in short duration, which are very liquid areas, will allow us to navigate these markets. So I know it is an incredibly tough time, and I can't predict what will happen, but I know that what I'm reading and seeing, that policymakers and the central banks are committed to supporting the global economy. And
so
asset allocation will be us surviving that.
So this is not 1929.
No, we learned a lot from 1929, and there may be aspects that look similar, but I think this is something that's very novel. We're advanced enough that this comes up with lots of tools, ways to address the environment. One of the new themes consultants talked about in their investment outlook was how support there is from the central banks permanently provide liquidity and support, and they are clearly trying to help make the market more liquid than they could be without their support. So just keep focused on the long term and having the right application.
All right, thank you, Kathleen. Hey, before we do the next question, hang on one second. This is Andrew. So I'm going to, I'm getting some comments about the reverb on the call. So I'm going to go back and mute everyone, but give you the option to unmute yourself if you need to ask a question. And again, that function will be *6. But let me go ahead and mute everybody's line, because I think it'll improve the call quality for everyone.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
All right, so we should be good now. Again, *6 will unmute you, and you can ask your question to Kathleen or Kathy. Thanks.
Hello. Hi, this is Steve Cohen from Wilmington, Delaware. First, I wanted to congratulate you guys for the work that you've done, you know, this past year and the years before that, and the work that you're doing today. So you had an excellent year last year, and we're so glad we're part of the UCEF. The question is guidance around withdrawals of money over the coming months, because even though you've got the cash there, which is great, is that usually a rebalance would then require you to sell equities in order to replenish that cash. So I wanted to know both, you know, what your thinking is. Certainly, we're not planning to take out any money for several months, but wanting to get your insights on that, as well as your rebalancing strategy, given the usual thing would be to buy more equity because the value has plummeted. So, thanks.
Andrew, I can take a stab at answering that, if that helps.
Yes, please. Yeah, go for it.
So, Steve, first, thank you very much for the compliments, and it's good to know that you are satisfied with the returns, and we're pretty sure we can continue to do so by following the same strategy, which is a long-term approach, and our disciplined rebalancing within the asset allocation. I wanted to highlight at the beginning that we do have the cash, which is there for planned draws on, I guess, a quarterly or a monthly basis, and then we have the income that comes into the fund as well. But I also highlighted the important allocation to short duration, where we're we have $13 million in that strategy, and that's a pretty significant overweight to where long-term policy is at 3%. So that's we've targeted some of that money to go towards community investing, which is a process that we are committed to, as Kathy talked about, and particularly in light of what's going on in the economy and the markets, we want to be able to do that. But we also have the flexibility from that overweight to use that in case there are draws from congregations that are going to find it tough as we experience the impact from the social distancing and the layoffs and the actions that are going to affect the labor markets and people's pocketbooks, which become so important to our funding. That liquidity is there, as well as what has become an overweight in the long-term treasury position. That also provides adequate liquidity. So we think we will want to do some rebalancing that makes sense, but we're being very targeted and looking for those opportunities. We do not feel that there is a rush to quickly reallocate some of this. Some of those allocations, just by the market action, are going to come down and increase. So we've got a lot of flexibility with what is I consider to be a really well diversified allocation to both the traditional public equity markets and fixed income markets. So no concerns there at all. Is that helpful?
Yes, very much. Thank you.
Sure.
Hello, this is Jim Rumbo.
Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hello? Yes. Jim Rumbo, San Jose UU. And I'd like to ask a question of Andrew about general church finances that go beyond the UUCEF. Is that okay?
We can do that. Hopefully, if we get
okay,
too far in the weeds, you and I can chat later, but go for it.
They're relevant to everybody, so if I could bring it up. What I'm going to tell my board tonight at our meeting is that I feel this crisis is likely to impact us in several ways. Since we're having virtual Sunday services, we're going to lose casual donations and probably some pledges for this year. The pledges for next year are likely to be down because people with investments have lost a lot of their wealth, and people with jobs, some of them are at risk. And I feel the pledge fulfillment rate is likely to be lower next year just because of all the uncertainty. So my recommendation to our board is that we should adopt a very tight budget, and in particular, we should not be adding any staff hours or new staff positions in this time of uncertainty, because those are hard to reverse. So I'd like your feedback on those thoughts.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think my assumption is that your base case is also correct, that things will be tight, that the wealth effect will maybe cause people to be to not pledge as much this year. We may have more unfulfilled pledges, so it does make sense to be careful when budgeting, but you also never really know, right? We could come out on the other side of this, and people could really feel like they need their congregation, and that going to church is something valuable to them, and it may not be as impactful as we think it's going to be. But I would tend to agree that you are correct. You don't necessarily want to plan on increased spending or increased headcount for the next year, just out of conservatism. But yeah, if you want to chat some more after the call, I think my contact information is in that deck, and I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
right. Anything else?
Question that doesn't involve the virus.
All right.
Are you there?
Yes. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay. George Carville, Brattleboro, Vermont. I'm chairman of the Social Environmental Action Committee, and I asked my treasurer this question, and she turned around and said to ask you. So what are the investments doing to divest from fossil fuel infrastructure? I've poked around and haven't found any answers on the UUA site.
So, yeah, we don't have a hard and fast divestment strategy when it comes to fossil fuels. This kind of goes back to a GA resolution from several years ago where we basically committed to be engaged on the topic of fossil fuels. My predecessor in this role, Tim Brennan, as was mentioned on the call, is still working as a consultant to the UUA and the Common Endowment Fund, and has been quite active in that. Tim, I don't know if you want to talk about, if you're still on, the work you did with Devin on all this. I think that's really instructive about the role that UUA is played in all this.
This is Kathy, if Tim's not on. So we are still we were based on the business resolution that passed at General Assembly in 2014, we reported at five consecutive General Assemblies about fossil fuel divestment. So the decision really was to divest unless there was the opportunity for engagement with those companies, which we've done mainly through the shareholder advocacy fund, although there has been there are some of the companies, for example, ConocoPhillips, where there's been a considerable investor dialogue, and so the UUA is a key player in that dialogue. But there is there's a video link on the homepage that is a progress report on our implementation of that business resolution, both through divestment and through engagement. And we did, I can't remember, Kathleen, maybe you remember how long ago that was, but we looked through the portfolio of the directly managed assets and in cases where there were fossil fuel holdings where we had not engaged and didn't see a possibility of engaging in the future, we got rid of those assets.
Andrew, this is Richard.
Kathleen, just want to add to that real quick.
I'm sure that we can, if we just review the minutes from the last couple of meetings, I think we'll find the answer there, because that it does seem like maybe that was something that came up and we discussed in November, as I recall.
All right. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate the extra detail there. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, everybody. I'm the Reverend Richard Nugent. I direct the Office of Church Staff Finances. And I just wanted to, I joined the call late because I was on another related call. But if it wasn't mentioned already, there is a comprehensive and growing web page, curating a variety of resources, uua.org/safe/pandemics. That's safe pandemics. Or you can go to our homepage, the UUA homepage, and I'm sure if you type in pandemics, you'll find it. There's a lot of resources there, but not the least of which is my staff team has our own page that is Congregations as Employers During the Pandemic, as well as there's another page from Stewardship on Facing Financial Stewardship Challenges. So all that you can find off of the homepage. Again, it's www.uua.org/safe/pandemics. And if you have any problems finding it, you can always send an email to our staff team and we can connect you, OCSF, OCSF at UUA.org. That stands for the Office of Church Staff Finances. We're going to be putting out some directives and suggestions and challenge issues around staffing and furloughs and what is the moral responsibility of our congregations in times of financial distress. Thanks.
No, thank you, Richard. I appreciate that. So it looks like we've been on for just about an hour. I'm sure Kathleen and Kathy don't mind sticking around for a couple more questions if there's still some out there, but we'll probably take probably no more than a two more.
Hello, this is Steve from Santa Monica.
Yes, Steve, go ahead.
Two points. I was reviewing the investment information memorandum from January 2020 yesterday, and under investment screening, it's saying that approximately 83.5% of the UUCEF's investments incorporate SRI/ESG criteria. So I think that's a general answer that the positive and negative screening that we apply leads to companies and investments that meet our values. I believe that those incorporate specifics like divesting from fossil fuel infrastructure. It also says the UUCEF actively avoids investing in companies whose products and business practices are harmful or unethical.
Yeah, that's right. That guidance, this is Kathy, that guidance, we have a socially responsible investment, a set of guidelines that describe how UU values are reflected in our investment policy, which were recently updated and which we then use as a basis for asking our research provider, Sustainalytics, to assess companies for inclusion or not, for overweighting or exclusion from our portfolio based on their performance on environment, social, and governance issues. One thing I wanted to add on the fossil fuel resolution, that was focused on the Carbon Underground 200, which are the leading holders of coal, oil, and gas reserves. So it didn't, that resolution doesn't specifically relate to fossil fuel infrastructure, but our commitments in terms of alignment with UU values on environmental issues are laid out in those socially responsible investing guidelines.
All right, thank you, Kathy. We have one more question out there.
Oh, just one nitpicky point. This is Steve White again.
Yes, Steve. Go ahead.
Somebody had a question about page 3, the rankings. I spoke with your staff yesterday, and in looking at the bottom right-hand corner of page 3, where the universe is 43 portfolios, I found it unlikely that just a straight ranking would place us 81st on a list of 43. And so Ms. Helbert explained that those, in fact, were not rankings as such, but percentiles, that the 46 would be the 46th percentile, the 81st percentile, and the 66th percentile, given that there were only 43 portfolios in the universe. So I think it's just the label.
You are correct, and thank you for pointing that out. You are right. It's percentile. But we're still above median, which is a good thing.
Right. It's just mislabeling.
Yeah. I always get confused on that one, but thanks for pointing that out.
This is Ward again in Pittsburgh. I just have one, thank God, brief question. It has to do with some terminology that appears on page 6. About our fixed income investments. I'm just curious to know what flexible fixed income and opportunistic investments refers to in a general way.
Oh, okay. So quick question. Let's see if I can answer it really quickly. There was a time when we had a category for opportunistic investments that were either hedge funds or strategies that had great flexibility across all markets.
Mm-hmm.
We have the ability to go there when we think we see a manager that could add value to the fund, but we've, for the time being, are not seeing anything, and mm-hmm. the flexible fixed income really is, these are fixed income managers only. They don't go across markets, but they do mm-hmm. have flexibility to incorporate global, so country risk, currency risk, and credit risk, which are great tools to have to offset what is likely to be a more challenging environment for traditional high-quality fixed income. So we have less exposure to those more esoteric strategies, while we mm-hmm. identify managers that have a skill set that we think complements our overall allocation. Does that help, Ward?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Super. Thanks.
All right, so I think we're going to wrap it up there. Again, if anybody has any questions that they thought of at the last minute or things they didn't want to ask on the call, please feel free to reach out to me. And if I can't help you, Kathleen and Kathy are always super helpful in filling in some of the blanks for me. So we'll get you the answers you're looking for. And I just hope everybody stays safe. We're thinking about everyone out there and love you all. Thanks for being investors in the fund and being committed UUs.
Thanks, everyone.
Talk to you next time.
Take care.
Thanks.